Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. Robert Reich says that broad prosperity is what makes a strong economy. Sounds simple, but in recent years, the United States has headed in exactly the opposite direction, he says. And with Republicans surging in the polls across the country, the Obama administration policies that favor increasing taxes on the wealthiest in America may not make it through the lame duck session ahead in December. Joining us now is Robert Reich. He is professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of a new book. It's called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Secretary Reich, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ann. It's good to be here.
You know, at this point, we probably won't have much of a roadmap on taxes until December, when Congress enters its post-election lame duck session and Republicans are expected to assert that this is a terrible time to raise taxes on anybody.
Well, I understand the argument. I actually think that it's a good time to continue the Bush tax cuts for 98% of Americans who need a tax cut. But the top 2% of Americans, and we're talking about people here who earn more than about $250,000 or $300,000 a year, to ask them to go back to the tax rates under the Clinton administration, I don't think is too great a sacrifice. I mean, after all, they don't spend nearly as high a proportion of their income as everybody else, so we're not going to get much of a kind of an oomph for the economy from them by giving them an additional year or more of tax cuts. While at the same time, we do have a long-term deficit, and if we give millionaire families that additional year of Bush tax cuts that they did not anticipate and were not built into the original Bush tax cut, that means $31 billion that is otherwise taken out of the budget that goes to these families, and we need that $31 billion if we're going to not only get the budget deficit down, but keep teachers in the classroom and pay for all of the things we need.
Let's hear from NPR's Robert Siegel in an interview with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday about extending those Bush tax cuts.
Everyone across the board, up until the highest income, get a tax cut.
But that tax cut would add $3 trillion to the deficit. If the impact on the deficit is bad for the highest income taxpayers, isn't the impact on the deficit also bad for middle class taxpayers?
No, for the following reason. Middle income taxpayers will use the money. Many of the people will be getting this tax cut, will inject it back into the economy, injecting demand into the economy, creating jobs. Tax cuts at the high end have not done that, as we can see in the Bush years.
Secretary Reich, is there enough of a tax cut ahead for the middle class to make that much of a difference at this point, since the unemployment rate's so high?
Yeah, and I don't think so. I would go further, and in my book, I do recommend going much further. I would say we need to exempt the first $20,000 of income from the payroll tax, for example, and maybe make it up by applying the payroll tax to incomes over $250,000. I would get rid of taxes for the middle class. I would actually provide wage subsidies for the middle class, make it up by not only raising the marginal income tax on people at the top, but also having what is essentially called a carbon tax, which would force us to look for alternative sources of energy rather than be so dependent on oil, which is costing us huge amounts of money when you consider our foreign policy and consider what happened in the Gulf of Mexico.
My guest is Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He has written a new book. It's called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. If you have a question or comment for our guest, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to our Facebook page at All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you've been a cabinet secretary in the Clinton administration, you're not new to politics. Where are we with the shakeout in the economic advisory team in the Obama administration? How does it work when you're trying to make such massive change when you have so much change up?
Well, the kind of change that's happening in Obama's economic team is not that unusual Japan in the third year of an administration, essentially, after the midterm elections, mm-hmm. A lot of things change. People do have to go back to their families or go back to their jobs. And the last 2 years have been pretty hard for that economic team. So I'm not surprised. It does give Obama the chance, though, to kind of push the reset button and have a slightly different economic team with a slightly different orientation.
You wrote that none of the standard booster rockets, I think this was in a New York Times column, are working, or they have failed to do enough. Have they had enough time?
Well, they've had enough time. I think the underlying problem is that we're really not dealing with an ordinary recession. We're dealing with a great recession that resembles the Great Depression more than it does anything else we've been through. So that the ordinary booster rockets, stimulus, financial stimulus through fiscal policy or even having the Fed reduce the interest rates to near zero and keep them there. Yesterday, the Fed Open Market Committee met and decided that it would keep interest rates near zero and try to continue to stimulate the economy. Those standard booster rockets are not working because the structure of the economy is out of whack. And this is what I really do emphasize in the book. It's the centerpiece of the book. Let me give you an example. As recently as the late 1970s, the top 1% by income in the United States was pulling in about 9% of total income. And then when you get to the 80s, the top 1% was pulling in about 12 to 15% of national income. And then in the 1990s, the top 1% was pulling in about 18% of national income. But by 2007, the top 1% was actually pulling in 23.5% of total national income. Well, the last time we saw anything like that was the year 1928. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's remarkable. 1928 and 2007 are the high water marks in terms of how much of the national income went to the top 1%. Well, is that a coincidence? In 1929, we had the Great Crash. In 2008, we had the beginning of the Great Recession. Is that really a coincidence? I suggest that it's more than coincidence, that when you have that much income going to the top, basically, the vast middle class doesn't have enough bargaining leverage, buying power, to buy the goods and services that the economy is capable of producing without going deep into debt. And those debt bubbles eventually burst, as we saw in 1929 and we saw in 2008.
After the crash in 1929, they did implement lots of reform policies, lots of reform. It doesn't look like much of that is going to happen this time, as you've mentioned. Does that mean if they don't do something soon, I mean, is there a tipping point where if something doesn't happen soon, the economy may never bounce back?
Well, the economy will eventually bounce back in terms of just showing a few more jobs and a little bit more economic activity. People have to replace cars, and they have to replace appliances that wear out, and they have to replace clothing that wears out. I mean, you know, a certain amount of things have to happen. Even after 1933, the economy started to improve. Mm-hmm. The problem is that you still are having an anemic recovery. It's not really a recovery. Most people don't feel it as a recovery. Unemployment is still terribly high. There's still enormous amounts of economic pain and insecurity out there. And you reach a tipping point in the sense that it's very hard for the economy to get on track and back on track without fundamental structural reforms of a sort that I've been talking about and I emphasize in the book. You also risk a kind of political backlash, because the longer it is that people feel angry and frustrated and feel that they have no power over what's going on, the longer it is that people feel that government and Wall Street or government and big business are somehow tilting the playing field, that the game is fixed, then you open the door to the politics of resentment, of a kind of demagoguery in which certain people, certain politicians essentially take advantage of the bad economy to promote and build their own kind of xenophobic, isolationist, nationalist, scapegoating politics. It can get very ugly. We've seen that before in this country.
The way you talk, I mean, some people are going to suggest that you're talking about redistributing income. You're talking about, you know, socialism.
Well, I'm not talking about redistribution because the rich, the top 1%, would stand to gain much more by having a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy and a positive politics than having a big share of an economy that's essentially dead in the water and a negative politics.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Carl, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, and greetings, Professor Reich.
Hi, Carl.
Question. Instead of economics, what I hear is numerology in the general media. Ooh, the numbers are up, the numbers are down. The Hebrews like the number 7 in the menorah. Lucky number 7, the number 3 is magic. Chinese acquaintance told me the number 8 is considered lucky.
Okay. Yeah, but isn't it amazing, Carl? You know, to think that this is a recovery, you know, it just boggles the mind.
Well, my specific question to you is, why do people talk about the numbers as if they are some kind of magic numerological entities that go dancing up and down, when in fact, I'm an engineer, and Isaac Newton ruined me. He taught me through the physics courses that if you analyze the smallest particles and use calculus to integrate them upwards, you can effectively build a brick wall out of atomic bricks.
Well, you said it just then, I think, very well. You can either kind of look at the numbers, the abstract numbers at the top, and think of the economy in a top-down way. You know, as long as the economy is growing technically, the GDP is growing technically, as long as...
You can do that, but
you can
doesn't
do it,
tell
but
you anything about
exactly.
The root causes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You cannot build a building without a foundation
exactly.
First.
And the foundation of this economy is average working people and small businesses and jobs and wages and how good those wages are. That's
and increasing that, as an engineer, we have a thing called a free body diagram where you draw a dotted line around the system.
Yeah.
And then you investigate what goes across the boundary, what comes in and what goes out.
Yeah,
and what's going out seem to be jobs, and what's coming back are manufactured goods with value added.
Yeah, well, you
now,
see,
until we correct the trade balance and the job loss and the frankly excessive wages in this country, we're going to all have to accept a lower income level, and we're going to have to start working more efficiently.
Carl, you mean excessive wages at the top? I mean, I don't think people in the middle. I mean, average people don't feel like their wages are excessive, even if they have a job. Most people's wages have been stuck, you know, adjusted for inflation for the last 30 years. I mean, the typical worker today is earning, adjusted for inflation, less than he earned 30 years ago. You know, the problem is not that people's wages are too high. The problem is people's wages are too low.
And the families have been able to survive, though, because women have been going to work at greater rates, much higher rates over the last 30 years, and easy access to credit.
Yeah. And in fact, there are three coping mechanisms, Anne, that I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Even though wages have stagnated over the last 30 years, you know, the first thing was women going into paid work. In the 1960s and 70s, only about 20% of women with young children were in the workforce. Now you got 65% of women with young children up in paid work. A lot of that is because that's the only way families have been able to continue basically maintaining their standard of living. Strategy number two was everybody working longer hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that certainly, but there's a limit to how far you can go down that road. And then finally, strategy number three was going deeper and deeper into debt, often using your home as a source of credit, refinancing, consumer loans, and so on. But that also reaches an end when the housing bubble bursts. So there's no longer any strategy to overcome the ultimate basic fact that wages have stagnated for most people over the last three decades, adjusted for inflation. And that means that unless we restructure the economy and make sure that the vast middle class does better, and again, I have some very specific suggestions mm-hmm. in the book, we're not going to see the economy recover.
We have to take a break. My guest is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. If you'd like to join the conversation when we return, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins at 2 o'clock this afternoon. On today's edition of the show, political junkie Ken Rudin joins Neil Conan in New York City to discuss all things politics. Join us for Talk of the Nation at 2. It's 77 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today. There is a slight chance of rain throughout the day, a high rate around 85. A few clouds tonight, a slight chance of rain, a low of 65 degrees. Sunshine and a near record high of 92 for tomorrow. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He has written a new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Secretary Reich, you've mentioned your solutions and that you've written about in the book. Are those the solutions that include things like higher education, making that more accessible? Can you tell us what those are?
Well, in the short term, and we've talked about some of these already, Anne, I think it is very important to cut taxes for the middle class, actually subsidize work and wages for the middle class and the lower middle class, working class, and the poor. Over the long term, there are ways we can boost productivity and improve education. Early childhood education is absolutely critical. I would make that universal. I would make college education free. But require that people in their first 10 years of full-time work pay back 10% of their full-time earnings. So that means that people who opt to become investment bankers and high-paid lawyers may be paying back much more in the first 10 years of their full-time work experience than people who go into, say, school teaching or helping provide legal services for the poor or do something else that may be more socially beneficial. But it seems to me that that is not only equitable but important for society.
How would that work? How could you flip around a system like higher education? Just doing it to the reforms for the health care has been more bloodshed than I think they reformed enough to take care of.
Yeah, you do it through public higher education, and you start with the student loan program. You say essentially anybody applying for a student loan, a federally provided student loan, you say, look, we have an alternative for you. And that is you can get free tuition. That is the government will give you free tuition and cover your college costs entirely if you agree to pay back 10% of your first 10 years of earnings into the fund that supports this program. And you build it from that point. I mean, you make it essentially originally voluntary, but it becomes very attractive to so many people, even people who think that they might possibly go into a high-wage career because most people don't know that they're going to make a high-wage career. But a lot of people say, well, that's a kind of system that sounds right. It sounds appropriate.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to speak to Secretary Robert Reich. And Susan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is an honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Susan.
I am a great follower of yours. I would like to pose to you a possible solution to our economic situation right now, especially with regard to baby boomers and the middle class. How do you think it would work if we went around Congress, who are never going to vote against the banks and the investment firms, and provided federal bonds to the middle class to invest in small businesses and entrepreneurs in this country to create new businesses with the stipulation that they do business in this country and get taxed, you know, they get breaks from up initial investments and taxes.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I understand your suggestions that people can buy bonds, you're saying that is basically lend money to a fund, and that fund would be set up especially for small businesses and small businesses that build jobs in the United States rather than abroad. And people who are lending money to that fund hopefully will do very well because small businesses, if the economy grows, will grow with the economy, and they will do being, you know, they will be doing well at the same time they're doing good because those are jobs in the United States. I think it's a great idea, but it presupposes that the economy can get back on a growth path. And what I'm suggesting in my book is that before we do what you're suggesting, it may be a very good idea, we first have to make sure that the vast middle class, lower middle class, working class of America has enough of the gains of economic growth that they can turn around and buy what is produced by Americans. So I would say all power to you, but let's at least start with the basic problem of a terribly weird maldistribution of income, worse inequality than we've seen since the 1920s.
But there are many areas where many of us sitting out here who have investment dollars, but we're afraid to invest in any. There's no place to invest them right now.
Yeah. Well, I completely understand that. All I'm saying is that there is not going to be any good place in the United States to invest those dollars until we turn around the economy, but the only way of turning around the economy is to give the vast majority of Americans the buying power they need to buy up what Americans can make and produce. So all I'm saying is that I understand your point, but they're not going to be the investment vehicles. They're not going to be good paybacks in the United States until Americans have the ability to buy.
Thank you, Susan, for your call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from a listener now. What does your guest think of the theory that banks and businesses are holding on to their trillions of cash reserves in order to hurt Obama and the Democrats' efforts to improve the economy? Also, does he think it was a mistake not to specifically mandate that TARP money be used only to make loans and not to pad the bank's asset reserves? I guess first the political question.
I don't think, and I haven't seen any evidence, that big businesses are holding back on what would otherwise be good investments for the purpose of hurting Obama. No, I think big businesses are sitting right now, and we know the Standard & Poor's 500 biggest businesses in America are sitting on a huge cash hoard of about $1.8 trillion. What they're doing with it is not expanding, because they don't feel that there are enough customers out there to warrant the expansion, at least in the United States. What they're doing instead is creating manufacturing facilities abroad. They are buying back their stock, which actually in the short term helps their stock prices to increase. They are investing in more labor-replacing technologies in the United States, and they are going on a binge of mergers and acquisitions, none of which creates a lot of new jobs in America. But I don't think they're doing it because they want to get back at Obama. They're doing it because the American market in terms of demand is basically dead in the water. I mean, they're just – consumers are laden with debt. Americans just don't have the wherewithal to go to buy a lot of stuff anymore. And that's really the centerpiece – that's the centerpiece of the problem. The old basic bargain that once linked pay to productivity has been severed. You know, that old bargain that even Henry Ford back in 1914 created, he gave his workers $5 a day, which at that time was three times what the average worker was earning in the United States, and a lot of people called him a fool or a knave. The Wall Street Journal called him guilty of economic crimes. But he did it because he said, wait a minute, my workers are also consumers, and if they get $5 a day, I think $5 a day, they are going to be able to turn around and buy Model T Fords. And they were able to do that. And Ford made a huge amount of money, and the workers did better. Well, it's that kind of basic bargain we've got to restore before we do anything else.
What about the TARP money being used only to make loans and not to pad the bank's asset reserves? Is there a way they could have controlled how that money was going to be used?
Yes, I think it was a tragedy that both the Bush administration and then the Obama administration didn't put some more strings on that TARP money, saying to the banks, number one, you've got to use this to help homeowners who are underwater reorganize their loans. You've got to use it to help small businesses. You've got to use this money to not to reward yourselves. Your pay cannot go up $1 from what it was before. In fact, you've all got to take a haircut in terms of your pay. Putting conditions on that money was sensible. It should have happened. And I think shame on the original Bush administration, but also on the Obama administration for not insisting.
My guest is former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. He's professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's author of a new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation, Sarah, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have an excess profit tax years ago. Well, I think we should have an excess income tax. If any of the upper management is earning more than 100% more than their lowest paid hourly employee, then they have to pay an excess tax, because it's getting so that the bottom is, I lost my job a few years ago, had to take a job at $10 an hour. That is not a livable wage for a single person. And I now have a better job, but it's still, I'm earning about 60% of what I had been earning before. And it's just very difficult to think that these CEOs and upper management are making these huge paychecks, yet at the bottom, they're making nothing, and it's not even a livable wage. So I just was wondering, would you think an excess income tax, anything over and above that, their lowest paid employee, 100% over their lowest paid employee, if that would work?
Well, I think it's a good idea, Sarah. In fact, you know, in the 1980s, the top executives, CEOs of biggest companies in America, were earning about 40 times what their average workers were earning. And then in the 1990s, it went up to about 100 times. And now the typical CEO of a big company is earning 350 times what the typical worker is earning. I mean, we've not seen this kind of weird, distorted disparity ever before. Well, we saw it in the 1920s, and I think that contributed, as I said before, to the Great Depression. But yes, I think that some sort of excess income tax, what I call for in the book, is basically raising the marginal income tax on people who are earning very, very high incomes, over $1 million, because after all, it's fair, it's necessary. Some people refuse to remember that under the Dwight Eisenhower administration, General Dwight Eisenhower became president as a Republican in the 1950s. Under him, the marginal income tax on the top earners in America was 91%. I mean, you know, nobody accused Dwight Eisenhower of being a radical. Well, we're very far removed from that. We're having a big debate in America right now in Congress about whether to go back to the Clinton top marginal income tax rate on the top earners, and that rate was 39%. Well, given that the top has never earned as much as they are now earning now, that is just it's unreasonable for CEOs to earn as much. It's very reasonable to ask them all, people at the top, to bear a little bit more of a burden of making sure that the deficit is reduced and teachers are in classrooms and this country can get back to the kind of middle-class prosperity we had before.
Thank you, Sarah, for your call. When it comes to the government investing its money, what about projects like the big infrastructure project, the rails, runways, and roadways spending they want to do across the nation, and particularly when it comes to rails? That's been a big topic of conversation in Ohio, where almost, it's almost a 50-50 deal right now. 50% don't want it. They think it's a stupid idea, and 50% want it and say it's going to create jobs. What about stuff like that?
Well, it depends, Anne, on the infrastructure we're talking about. We know that if we're talking about basic rail, roads, also sewers and piping systems and all your basic infrastructure needs in this country that we have not invested for years. We're disinvesting. We are way behind. There is deferred maintenance. And when bridges collapse or when, in fact, near where I live in California, a basic, you know, a huge natural gas pipeline exploded, killing people and destroying an entire neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to that point, you say to yourself, you have to say to yourself, hold it. We have got to invest and reinvest in our infrastructure, get it up to world-class standards, not only so that we can all be productive and generate a lot of jobs, but also so the United States doesn't continue to fall behind.
614-292-8513 if you want to talk with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. And Mitch, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Hi, Mitch.
Good morning. I recently spent 2 months in Ethiopia, and Ethiopia has tons of educated people, and they have no jobs. They're producing all kinds of educated people, but they're really way behind on creating the opportunities. And I think that's the story in America. We don't lack educated people for jobs. We have this intent of reducing every job to the lowest common denominator and not using the talent that we already have. And we're perpetrating a fraud on current students who are incurring this huge debt. And when they come out, there's no place for them to make a living to pay it back.
Secretary Reich?
Well, Mitch, I disagree with you on that. I think that all what we know is that the jobs of college graduates are better. The pay of college graduates are substantially better. In fact, if you look back over the last 30 years, college graduates have earned a premium that continues to grow over the pay going to people who did not go to college or didn't graduate college and have a high school degree as their last degree. And that premium keeps on growing. The job problem we have right now comes because of issues that I talk about in my book, that there's not enough demand coming from the middle class, and the middle class have not got enough of the piece of the national, a large enough share of the national economic gains, and therefore finally has run out of coping mechanisms, and therefore can't turn around and buy what is produced. No, I think the real problem is that we don't have enough people who have an adequate education to provide more and more value in an increasingly integrated global economy. I can see my own students. I teach at the University of California, Berkeley. They are, granted, having a difficult time getting jobs right now, but overall, they are on the winning side of the Great Divide. College-educated people will do fine in this economy over the long term if we get the basic economy, the fundamentals of the economy, right in terms of providing the middle class with an adequate share of the fruits of that economy.
We have to take another break. My guest is former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. His new book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. We'll get back to those calls when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV, Secrets of the Dead sheds light on what's been called one of the most outrageous escape stories in the history of the high seas. In 1876, six Irish political prisoners escaped to America from Australia on board an American whaler ship. Secrets of the Dead tracks down descendants of the prisoners and explores the swashbuckling details of the dramatic rescue through reenactments of key events. Relive this dramatic history Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll hear about preserving Ohio's historic barns for agriculture and adaptive reuse. We'll also discuss the renovation of the oldest known barn in Upper Arlington to create a community center. That's All Sides at 11 o'clock on WOSU.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts. Breast cancer survivor and author of The Middle Place and Lift, Kelly Corrigan, will share her experiences Thursday, September 30th at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org.
78 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41 this morning. Sunshine today. There is a slight chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm, a high of 85. A few clouds and a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 65 degrees. Sunshine and a near record high of 92 for tomorrow. All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. We're talking about the next economy and America's future, which is the subtitle of his new book, Aftershock. Tom, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Ann. Hi, Mr. Secretary.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I hope, speaking of education, I for a long time have been trying to figure out and understand the statistics that they put out on productivity so that I react properly when I hear the statistics. And I haven't been able to figure out how that is figured. The question is, is it possible that when productivity increases, it simply means that people are being paid less? Is that part of the equation, or is it that more work per hour is achieved? Or how is that done so that I can either feel sad or glad when I hear the result?
Well, you can. It depends upon really always, and this is true of any economic statistic. You've got to get under the statistic and look at the reality. Productivity essentially means how much value, measured in terms of how much people are willing to pay for something, is generated from each worker. Now, you can increase productivity, that is, increase value per worker, by laying people off and having everybody work longer hours. And making things pretty measurable for a lot of people. Or you can also increase productivity by giving people more responsibility, better education, better job training, giving them all sorts of benefits that make them more productive. If you take a kind of a top-down view of the economy, a kind of Wall Street view, then productivity comes primarily from cutting your workforce and utilizing everybody to a higher extent, that is basically working everybody harder. If you take a ground-up view of the economy, which is what I recommend, and we talked earlier on this show about, then productivity comes from giving everybody really more opportunities to be more productive through becoming better educated, having better training, contributing more to the workforce and to the workplace, perhaps in getting more involved in problem solving and a more sense of ownership, that they are really assets to be developed rather than costs to be cut.
Thank you, Tom, for your call. We're going to move on to another Tom. Tom, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I agree with the professor. You know, I've actually been able to understand what he's been talking about. Okay.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Now, my thing is, the thing that I would propose is what I call a fair wage tax. And what that is when these companies move their businesses overseas to produce products at a lower rate because they can get the workers there for less money, that corporation, not the goods coming in, but the corporation itself, be taxed for the wages that are lost due to them moving out of the country.
How does that work, Secretary Reich, in a world economy?
Well, unfortunately for Tom, I think I understand the sentiments behind what he's saying, and I agree with those sentiments. The problem is it's much more complicated than that, because right now what used to be called American companies are becoming global companies. They are owned by shareholders all over the world. They have employees all over the world. GM, for example, is selling more cars in China than it is in the United States and making them there, most of them. Westinghouse has more sales outside the United States and more employees outside the United States than it does here. A lot of what we think of as American companies, like 7-Eleven, are actually owned by foreigners. It's not clear who's us and who's them. It's not clear what's outsourcing and what's insourcing. I mean, it's all these big companies are becoming global entities that are doing everything everywhere, selling everything everywhere, owned by everybody everywhere. As a result, it's just very hard to control them or even decide what to tax and how to tax. I think it's important also to understand that a lot of our job losses have been due to technological displacement. You know, we used to have a lot of bank tellers and telephone operators and service station attendants. That's not because of globalization that we lost them. It's because of automation. And even go into a factory today, a lot of factories that I go into have robots and numerically controlled machine tools, and they have a relatively small number of technicians sitting behind computer consoles controlling all of these things. The old assembly line with a lot of people working behind the assembly line, that's becoming obsolete.
But even the assembly line, there was a surge in technology 50, 60, 70 years ago, too.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, that's my point, Ann. 50, 60, 70 years ago, that surge in technology led to the first wave of mass production. And because we didn't have unions, because we didn't really have any kind of protections for workers, because we didn't know even how to restructure the economy, most of the gains of the economy went to the very top. And in the 1920s, we saw huge inequality. In fact, by 1928, the top 1% were taking home about 23.5% of total national income. And then, of course, came the Great Depression. Well, since then, certainly since the 1980s, we've seen a new wave of technology: cargo ships, containers, satellite communication technologies, eventually the computer, eventually the internet, all of which have made it far easier for corporations to do everything everywhere on the globe, and also to replace routine workers in the United States with machinery. And the question is, just like the question was in 1929 when we hit the Great Depression because people didn't have enough purchasing power, ultimately, they couldn't borrow anymore. Ultimately, the question now is, how do we make sure that the fruits of the economy, the gains of the economy, are more equitably shared so that Americans have the buying power they need to keep going, to buy what the economy is capable of producing. And at the same time, over the long term, give Americans the kind of education they need, we need, to be truly competitive in this new world economy.
Thanks to Tom for his call. And Mike, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very, very interesting show. I agree with everything you're saying. But I wonder, you know, I watch Fox occasionally. I don't know why. I guess I'm a masochist. But they talk about, you know, redistribution of wealth. If we're being represented by our congressmen and our senators, if 5% of the people in this country make 95% of the money, why is it that 95% of the people aren't being represented by our congressmen and senators? They're there to protect the wealth and investment of the wealthy, and they just don't seem to understand your concept that the middle class is what makes a strong country.
I wish I could give you an upbeat and optimistic answer, Mike. Unfortunately, as wealth and income become concentrated at the top, so does political power. I'm dating myself now. I was there in the Ford administration. I was there in the Carter administration briefly. I was there as Secretary of Labor briefly, for 4 years in the Clinton administration. And every time I went back to Washington, And by the way, every time I felt like I was hitting my head against a wall trying to expand the circle of prosperity, but that's another story. But every time I went back to Washington, there were more lobbyists, there were more public relations professionals, more lawyers representing big corporations and the very rich than before. And right now, Washington is completely overrun with lobbyists for big corporations and the wealthy, which is one reason our representatives, senators, and congresspeople may not be listening to us, because the people at the top are giving them a lot of campaign contributions and supporting their political careers. The Supreme Court, remember this year, earlier this year, came up with a bizarre, I think in some ways a shameful decision, saying that corporations are people entitled to First Amendment rights. And so basically opening the floodgate to big corporations and contributions to political candidates. What we have got to do is make sure that even the rich in this country understand a very important principle. And that principle is that it is better to have a smaller share of a growing economy and a positive politics that goes with a growing economy than to have a huge share of an economy that's dead in the water and a politics that's growing increasingly negative.
Thanks to Mike for his call. And now coming up, let's see, 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation, Alan, you're on the air. You want to talk about the nonprofit system.
Yeah, thanks. Secretary Wright, I remember reading in a previous book of his, he cited statistics about the tax-exempt organization, the nonprofits, the foundations, and so forth, where over 80% of their money was going to projects that weren't related to poverty and such. And I just wondered, hasn't that become a racket where all their money is it's become a sort of a tax avoidance scheme where the money is not going to the poor? And wouldn't it be a big help, in especially times like this, where if the government wouldn't direct all nonprofits to have to give out a minimum amount of their funds to poverty and housing in areas like Appalachia and such like that?
Yes, I agree with you. You're referring to something that I once wrote, and I still believe that. I've proposed that there really be kind of two levels of charitable contribution. If somebody wants to give money to a symphony orchestra or an art gallery or an Ivy League college or any other place that doesn't necessarily cater to poor people, but provides some public benefits, those so-called charitable contributions ought to have some tax benefit attached to them, but they should not have as much tax benefit, as much of a tax deduction attached to them as charitable contributions that go directly to institutions and agencies set up for the poor. And otherwise, why do we call it a charitable deduction? I mean, otherwise, we are just having people get full deductions for supporting their own colleges and universities, the culture palaces that they frequent that have absolutely nothing to do with helping the poor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Alan. 614-292-8513, although we have lots of calls waiting. And Karen, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you. I have a comment to make about legislation. Wages are not only stagnant, but they're being reduced by legislation. I had a job abolished, and I lost about 24 years' worth of wages because your job raises were supposed to go with you when your job gets abolished. But back in 2006, the Board of Trustees at Ohio State passed a House bill, House Bill 187.
Okay, Karen.
Yeah.
Secretary Reich doesn't know about that House bill, and you've called before. So you want to talk about wages going down as a result of legislation, but that's a state issue.
Karen, I wish I did know more about what's going on in Ohio, but I can tell you that adjusted for inflation, and we've got to always adjust things for inflation, wages have been stagnant for the typical American worker. And on top of that stagnant wage, you've seen payroll taxes go up. You've seen sales taxes go up We've seen a lot of property taxes around the country go up, but the taxes on the top earners who have taken home more and more and more in 2007, the latest data for which we have any notion of what happened, 23.5% of total income in this country, their marginal taxes have actually continued to drop. And that, it seems to me, doesn't make any sense if we want to rebuild the middle class and also if we want to reduce the long-term budget deficit. It's just insane.
Thanks to Karen for listening. And also, Jackie, you're on the air. Welcome to the program. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
No problem.
My question has to do with the patience or lack thereof of the American public right now. It seems to me that the economy needs time to go through the process, to recover. There are no quick fixes, in my estimation. But yet, and part of this may be politicized, part of it may be that the American public is used to instant gratification through the Internet and cable news and whatnot. But everybody wants it fixed now. Realistically, how long will it take to turn around the economy, do you think?
Well, Jackie, what I say in my book is that we're not going to turn around the economy at all. At least for average people, for the middle class and working class people in this country, until we reorganize it so that average working people get a bigger portion of the benefits of the economy, because there's no way right now of having a recovery if most people don't have enough money to actually buy the goods and services that the economy is capable of producing. We're in a kind of vicious downward cycle. So it's not a typical recession when you can just wait it out and just hope that it turns up eventually. This is much more like the Great Depression, when we had to reorganize society completely. During the Great Depression, we created a right to organize labor unions, for example. Organized labor did not have that right before 1935. And so that by 1950, about 33% of all workers in this country belonged to a union, and they had the bargaining leverage to get better pay. And then they turned around and used that better pay to buy all of the things that they created, the goods and services that they made. And their pay packages set prevailing wage rates even in the non-unionized sector. But these days, we can't rely on unions because unions are less than, in the private sector, 8% of the workforce. And that means that we've got to think about other ways of reorganizing the American economy so that average working people get a larger piece of the action. Otherwise, we're going to be in this quandary we are now in forever. I wish I could agree with you. I wish it was just a matter of waiting it out. Yeah. It's not.
Secretary Reich, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
It's former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, author of Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.